David Gunger, how are you, my brother?
Ian, I'm so well, and I love you. It's so good to be here with you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, man, I love you, too, and I miss you. I miss our times together in Manhattan and our times together out in Connecticut and just having a sort of a regular David Gunger infusion. It's not my diet is sorely missing that nutrient.
We need to make that change. We somehow need to find a way to get together more often.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're making time to get together with us today, and I know that the folks who listen to Typology will benefit from what you have to say, because you're a longtime student of the Enneagram. You have a lot more knowledge of it than the average bear, and I want to just alert people to something that's fascinating, and I was thinking about this on the drive over to the studio this morning, was how hard it was for a while for you to figure out your type. Like, we were going between 4, we were going to 8. What else do we have? 4, well, 8, and what else?
I originally thought I was a 7. My father's a 7. My brother, Rob, is a 7. And Gungers like to party. So I thought I was a 7. And then hanging out with you, I remember the first time I told you I was a 7, you just looked at me quizzically and just like, buddy, you don't know what you're talking about. And I remember I was in your...
I didn't say that, but
we were actually in... This was the first time I ever met you. We were in your lovely home before you went back to the East Coast. You were in Franklin, and I'm meeting you, and I had heard so much about you, and you were... I always say, this is a side note, and I don't mean to just, butter you up here, but the first time that we met, I was in a kind of a crisis of my own faith and life and identity and figuring out what I wanted to do, and you had steered me in this direction, and I just, at that moment, had fallen in love with you in a way of as a spiritual mentor for me and a brother that I loved you dearly. And I remember telling you, I think I'm a 7 and being so confident in it. And you just giving me a look of like, dude, you have no idea what you're talking about. And so later on, we had spent much more time together. And later on, the first time that you and Suzanne had... I don't know if it was the first time you guys had done something together, but it was, you were leading a retreat together, and it was the first time that I got to go to it in Connecticut. And in the thing, everybody's saying, do you think you know what you are? And I thought I knew what I was. I thought I was a 7. And I remember that night, learning through everything, the thing about the 7 that didn't quite make sense was 7s avoid pain. And I don't avoid pain at all. I kind of lean into the moment of discomfort or darkness. And that night I played some music and I played it. And Suzanne told me, oh, honey, you're not a 7. I think you might be a 4. And then I loved that idea because I had so many friends that were 4s. And the 4 has actually a lot of, in my opinion, has a lot of things kind of similar to an 8 in that they're both individualists.
Both passionate.
Both very passionate, and both can enter into darkness and into themes that are not just happy and care about justice, And so I lived as a 4 for probably a good 6 months. And the next time we saw each other at something, I really lived into my 4-ness. I'm like, I love this. I loved being a 4. But I remember my brother Michael, just telling me straight up, man, I don't think you're a 4. I've known you since you're a kid. I think you're an 8. And I'm just like, how dare you? I am not an 8. I never would want to be an 8. 8s, I thought, were the biggest jackals. I didn't have many 8 friends. I just was like, this is no. And then talking to my wife, and my wife was the final, Kate said to me, I laughed because she kept on kind of dropping these hints that I really think you're an 8. And then the final thing was, 4s, the thing that 4s struggle with is they struggle with envy.
Careful.
With envy.
Careful.
Right?
Yes.
And
yes, we do.
My wife said, so you're going to tell me that you're envious of anyone? And right away, I laughed because in our marriage, she knows me. And I don't get envious. I don't ever have. I'm a bald man, you know, I went bald at an early age. And of course, I'd maybe be like, oh, I love that hair. I wish I had hair. But I would never, like, I'm me. I'm not going to try to be something I'm not. And she knows that about me. So she kind of, you know, pokes me a little and says, so you're going to tell me that you're envious over being lustful? And she just caught me in my tracks. And right away, I thought, oh, I better lean into like learning more about A. And then talking with my family and talking with people that know me, Michael, my coworker, and learning more about eights. And like, oh my gosh, I am just, of course, I'm an eight. So it took me, you know, a couple of years. And yep. And I've gone to, you know, like five different Enneagram type workshop boot camp type things. And I think it was by the third one that I finally embraced, okay, I'm an eight, you know? And that's where I'm at today. Now, I love what you say, and I'm sure you've said this a million times on your podcast, but I love that you talk about, you know, if you're going to say, what's your favorite color? And you're going to say blue, how many shades of blue there are. I'm going to definitely say that I'm a unique eight and that I lean real hard seven. And I don't know. I still, even though I really have embraced the eight thing, there are a lot of characteristics about eight that sometimes maybe from my own background or my own ego or whatever you want to say, that I kind of push against. Like, I'm not the typical eight in that I have to be, well, not that all eights are this way, but I know the shadow side of eight so much that I never want to be the only guy in charge or the only leader, because I just don't really trust eights. And so right. I just don't want to have anyone that's a controlling leader over me. So the people that I work with right now, what's really great is that we have a great working relationship, because I'm an eight, he's a three. And with John, my other partner in music, I think you got the double eight zone, which is kind of a funny thing because it's either, you know, fireworks or beauty, whatever you want to say. So it's
John is an eight.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why did I think John was a five?
Well,
didn't you tell me he was a five?
I thought he was a five forever, but then I actually think if you know where eights go to, and
I don't want to talk about this.
John would be so pissed at me if I said he is an eight. He is not. He's still the person that's like, I'm not gonna fully buy. You know, I'm not gonna fully get into that yet. So, but if you know, you know, when you know, you're like, oh yeah, yep. we're a couple eights. So.
You guys share a line. It actually is amazing though how many fives are in your life. Kate's a five, right?
So what's funny is, and this is just the experience
has the weather changed on Kate?
She changes every day, but she knows she really thinks she's a four, and she wants to be a four. And she's a four with a five wing, and there's always.
Well, I would like to be a Tonka truck, but that doesn't really mean.
I know, but she does. If you were going to go on, and this is where, like, you know, not that this is where it's funny, because how much that vice actually can sometimes be like, kind of can bring a little clarity. She resonates more with four on a lot of things, and on big things that are like right. vices and those things, like four really does come up more. And she's kind of landed there, but she still likes in her own individuality. She sometimes, you know, she thinks she could wander. I think she loves nine, so the future of humanity. She wants to be a nine, I think. Her dad is a nine, I think. And she sometimes thinks that, or else, you know, five or three, but she's a four.
Well, I mean, you've said two things that are really helpful for people. One is, and I like to remind people of this all the time, it can take a long time to figure this out. It's not like, you know, going on Vogue magazine and taking a personality quiz, you know, and like, or coming up with, oh, here's my spirit animal. You know, it's like, no, actually, this thing's pretty intense. And when you really make a commitment to trying to figure out your way of being in the world, you know, your dominant way of being in the world, I mean, it can take a while. And part of the problem is that you're the problem with personality sometimes is it's always with you. So you really can't step outside of this mystery and objectively, you know, diagnose it. And so it's a wonderful journey, but oftentimes a frustrating one. Took me 10 months, took you some time, it's taking Kate some time, but I think the journey is worth it.
I think what it breeds, and it's the most thing that it's the biggest thing that it's been helpful for us, is relationships, and it's a type of language that breeds empathy. Mm-hmm. And so I think sometimes one of the reasons why it's hard for us to find our number is because we're the last people we want to be empathetic about. And so I think it gets us in a place of, you know, our ego has so much, we project what we want to be or what we feel or pain or whatever. And trying to get back to that essence idea of, well, what is the thing I'm missing? What is the thing? What are these, what is this language that helps us see, I think, others first, and then it really helps us kind of balance out. And in that wrestling with it, it kind of builds a muscle of empathy. And so for us, it's just, mm-hmm. it's been huge for our working relationships and really for our marriage, mm-hmm. and for our friendships, our family, to try to see the world the way they see it.
Yeah, I think that's so much of the end game, right? Is that you have access to all nine lenses and the ability to swap them out to understand in any given moment how a person is seeing the world, how it differs from the way you do. It helps you then avoid flying into reactivity because people are responding in a way that you don't understand, and it may be rubbing you in some strange way, or it's, you know, firing something in you that, you know, it's hard to understand, but it's, you know, it just helps on so many levels to have this kind of wisdom. And that's what it is, right? It's not just intelligence. It's a kind of wisdom that is, you know, incredibly helpful to self-development. So let's go back to this idea of fives, because I thought you were going to, now everybody in your life is changing, which is completely screwing me up. But it, what I was going to say was, originally, you just have so many fives. Michael's a five. Is Michael still a five, or has he changed?
Michael is a five. Michael is a five. And I like five. I think, fives have... Oh, man. Fives, I feel like fours think they're the most unique number. I think fives are the most unique number. They are. Some of my favorite people and thinkers and friends are fives. And I'm friends with... It's funny I say this. I'm friends with a lot of... Oddly, a lot of threes, a lot of fours, and fives end up in my life for some reason. I don't know if that's because of where I live or because of my profession, whatever that is. But three, fours, and fives end up in my life. And a lot of times, for the fives, it's interesting because an eight can, you know, obviously go to five. And my relationship with going into that kind of lens of... almost using knowledge as a power or a trump card or something can be dark. So to see a healthy five actually a lot of times is like they become spiritual leaders in my life of kind of have so much wisdom and guidance. And obviously I have a brother who's older than me and has been, one of my best friends and such a dear mentor. And I love him. We have a great relationship. But I think that, for me, and it's interesting because I'm in seminary right now and in a learning environment. There's part of me as an eight that loves the idea of being a five, but obviously I feel like for instance with my brother Michael, he can go into his woodshed and just totally be alone. And for me, I can go into my woodshed, but I feel like I have to show everybody my woodshed and be like, look what I'm doing. Look what I'm doing.
There's that seven wing. You know, we've written some music together. I've been in some pretty creative environments with you. And one of the things I would say about you and not needing to be in control, I was, again, thinking on the way over here. So we've done, music together, yeah. Live. And I know when you arrive at a gig, you may not be aware of it, but you're in control. I mean, it's not like, you're like, there's not, I never feel like you're diplomatic. So there's some awareness there, but you are definitely in charge in the room. And everybody, whether they're in the band or not, feels it. I mean, there's like an energy field. You definitely have an energy field.
My bandmates joke that it's like, it's chaotic control in that it seems like it's chaos, but I have intentionality to it. Like in my mind, I'm like, okay, there is a plan. Even if people from the outside look like, man, are they just flying by the seat of their pants right now? It's like, for me, I know a lot of times I'm going for a feel, like, how do you describe this? And this sounds odd, but like, you know, you want a certain feel, you know, you want to get somewhere. And I've got kind of a path in which I want to get there creatively, but also I'm not like the most organized person. You know this, a lot of times I would come into a place and I'd be like, okay, I just wrote this song or I just did this thing. And the wonderful thing about working with you is because you have you are an artist yourself, you take a lot of creative risk, right?
Yeah, I'd like to think so.
Yeah, and I like to work in an environment where I feel like there's trust for creative risk and to try out new things. But if you're the type of personality that, you know, wants everything really planned and stick to the plan, then a lot of times I feel like it could be infuriating for a personality like me, because on one side, I do have a plan, even though I might not be the best at articulating that plan. And I'm going with that plan no matter what, kind of full steam ahead, which can seem almost like, oh, I could see that being feeling just like chaos. And yet, because we've worked together enough and because we have that trust and I feel like I try to learn to be less chaotic, I felt a lot of empowerment. And when an eight, I feel like, feels empowered, they can kind of thrive. And give back. So if they don't feel empowered, I feel like that's where we get, my slogan is kind of, you know, and this is terrible, but I always joke around and say this. I'm like, oh, get out of my face, which is just like, don't get in my way. Get out of my face. Let me have room to breathe. Let me have room to be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I worked with another guy who's also very talented. This guy, Rob Mathis, who's just like you. He would come rolling into things and he would be like, I stayed up all night. He's very, very intense like you. And I stayed up all night and I wrote this song. It's amazing, you know? And I'd be like, oh, really? Yeah, I think it's a song cycle. There's four of them, you know? And I'd be like, oh my gosh. And then I would literally, we would have all this stuff planned that we were going to do. And I would have to turn to the band and go, throw out the charts. Because it was like, but here's the deal. I trusted that what he brought in was as good or better than anything I had planned. So I would not have given people leeway if I knew, if I had any doubt or if I had significant doubt that this could not end well.
Yeah.
So that's a testimony to my trust in your talent and your skills.
Well, thank you. And I mean, I not that people need to hear this, but it really was one of my favorite things. My family, we had four children and we moved to New York from the Midwest. And Kate and I, we had been married for almost 10 years and we'd always want to live in a big city. And then we end up in New York, and to have you be on the East Coast and us be able to come and see you. And we would come in, you know, at least, you know, a couple times a month and be able to spend time with you and Anne. It was like heaven sent for us. It was you were our second family here on the East Coast. And so for us to be able to have a working relationship, but also just a friendship for our family was so dear. And then to be able to be introduced to the Enneagram in that way, and kind of struggle through that and wrestle through that, it's like a gift that we'll always be grateful for.
Well, I appreciate that, man. That means a lot. All right. So, you know, eights, I was teaching this weekend. I had about 200 people in a class here in Nashville. I had a ball with them. And one of the things that I've been doing that's been so different and so exciting for me is I'm not lecturing anymore. Like, I talk for a little bit and then I just bring up panels and I just interview people. And it is so much more fun and so much. You talk about artistic risk because you don't know. You know, you may get four or five, three people up there that could go bad on you, you know. But it has been so like enlivening and fun to have that. And people just seem to dig it so much more, you know. They're so much more engaged. So we were talking this weekend with a group of fives. I mean, with eights, and just talking about vulnerability, confusing vulnerability with weakness, and how eights do that, and as a central feature of the of that type. And one of the questions I asked him was, when have you felt in your life most vulnerable and weak, and what ultimately was the effect of that experience on you? Like, yeah. So what was that for you?
Oh, see, you just know how to hit the eight pressure point. I feel like every eight, because we want to be strong, and because I feel like we want to be authentic, we really long for authenticity. We become inauthentic because I want to say, and I know this sounds a little clumsy as I get there, but like, I want to really believe that I am being authentic with you and that I am being vulnerable with you. So I'll share a story right now that makes it seem like I'm being really vulnerable. And I want to believe that I'm being really vulnerable. But the thing is, eights at the very like core of them, because at some loss of innocence or some loss of trust, if you really feel like you betrayed an eight, it's hard for us to ever. Now, we can dive into my story later a little bit more into where this sometimes gets a little confusing for me, but I feel like I'm very loyal to my family, right? You don't mess with my family. And if you've ever messed with my family, I almost feel like I go Arya on Game of Thrones, which for people who are not super nerds, like she has a list of people, right? And I almost have the thing of like, you don't mess with my family. I have my list. And it doesn't mean that I hope that anything terrible happens to you, but I'm kind of done with you, right? And for me, I bring that back around saying like, dude, who am I vulnerable with? Because if I'm vulnerable with everybody, I think there's a part of me deep inside that almost doesn't trust that, you know, because at the core of me, somewhere along the line, I felt like innocence was taken away, which means I don't fully trust the world or everyone. And when I lean into that, the people who I do trust, I like really, really, really trust, you know? And so to lean into the times of feeling like, when did you feel most weak or most vulnerable? I think it's the times that I hurt those who I trust. And then actually trying to deal with that. And it's still so hard to think about those times. Where you feel like you totally let someone down, you know? So I said all of that to buy enough time to be like, do I really have to think of the time I was most vulnerable?
I'm a therapist. I can wait a long time.
Yeah, I know.
I can watch you squirm a long time.
So let's go some pressure points, and maybe I'll just do, here's my therapy session with you for the world. I'll just maybe say some things and maybe I'll end up landing on it going like, that's it, right? So by saying some things, I'll say some memories that I felt like maybe I brought shame on some level to those who I trust most or love most. And I think for me, without going into too much detail, especially about names and that type of thing, my dad, when I was in junior high, was a mega church pastor. And he ended up having an affair with essentially our nanny, right? Or a closest babysitter. And there were things that happened during that time where I was a kid, and whatever you want to say this is, I think on one level I'll just say it. So I was having dreams at that age, at like seventh grade, that my dad was having an affair with this person. And I would have these crazy nightmares, and I would tell my dad about it. And at the time, he lied to me. And just said, oh, I would never do that. You know, that's crazy. And then I think what was weird is I was in such a hyper religious environment in Tulsa at a private Christian school that sometimes the way that people talked about dreams was hyper spiritualized, you know, that I ended up really wrestling with when everything came out was that God telling me this, or was that, and I blamed myself for it. like The Affair. And then ended up, there was a couple of moments that were really hard. One of them was too personal to share right now, and I'm sorry, I'd say that for the protection of people I love. But another one that I just will share was at the time we were really worried about my dad's safety when everything had come out. He couldn't be found. And we called this woman. And my mom was on the phone, and this woman who was like essentially, you know, a babysitter for years and years had said, we're asking where it is. And I'm just in seventh grade and I'm just going, please, you know, I'm crying. Please, can you tell me if you know where he is? Can you please tell us? And she ends up kind of apologizing. And then she says, and I'm too young to kind of process what's going on, but she says to me, I love you. And I, in response, like really quickly just say, I love you too. But I knew my mom was on the phone. And as soon as I said that, I felt such shame because I felt like, oh my gosh, what did I just do to my mother? What did I just make her endure? And that little moment shaped so much, tied with another moment of me kind of catching, feeling like something was wrong with these dreams, and a third incident that was even more real where my dad had lied to me when I felt like there was something going on. I kind of caught something weird going on. I felt like it was all my fault. I felt like there. And so I felt like I had to keep their marriage together. Now, luckily, and through the grace of everything that is good and holy, my parents ended up working on their marriage. They've been married. That was over 20 years ago. They've been married and totally healthy. It's a great story of redemption. But in the midst of that chaos, our family got super, super tight. And there were other little traumas that would happen along the way that I think somehow I internalized feeling like, on some level, I betrayed my mom, and my biggest fear would ever be falling into the same type of traps that my father fell into, or betrayal, or those types of things. And you know that eights tend towards lust, right? And it's more than just sexual lust. But just through all of those, I feel like for me, for with Kate, with everyone, sometimes out of fear, you react certain ways and you get hostile in certain things and you get aggressive in certain ways. And when things come back up, they're like little triggers. So for instance, I've been working in churches since I was a young guy, like 18, got hired at a mega church in Michigan. They didn't know how old I was. And I started working as a worship leader for like high school and college groups at this large mega church. They ended up making me a youth pastor, worked there for 4 years, went to Tulsa, worked at my parents' church, and then they kind of joined with another church, worked there. Then I moved to Arizona, worked at another like mega church again. And through all of these, in a matter of about, you know, 12 years, I had 8 different leaders who had affairs in some way at churches. So, and each one was different and odd, and I'll share a few that kind of like maybe go like get a little ouch, because the obviously everything had happened with my dad. One of the people that came in during that time who was a family friend was a guy named Ted Haggard, right? And for a lot of people, they may remember that name Ted had his own demons and his own scandal in At that time, he made some decisions that really kind of had hurt our family and felt like a betrayal of trust. He ended up taking that woman, and she's been totally, fully life healed. And it's a beautiful story of redemption all the way around, where she has a family and she's doing really well. But he had brought that woman to his church, which we had family vacationed with these people. And all of a sudden, to feel like someone that's kind of a spiritual leader, take another woman, kind of not talk at all to your mom, you know, to once again to this place of like who you feel like you have to protect. Later, when everything had happened with him, the feeling of betrayal again, back to when you're like a junior hire, being like, wow, you were such a hypocrite. Then my first boss at the church I'm working at, he had an affair. Then my next boss at the church I'm working at, he had an affair. to then he and he the second guy at this church was would always try to kind of claim himself to be my mentor, even though like I would never say he was my mentor. He always like he was my self-proclaimed mentor, and we ended up I moved a worship leader that I was with under at my parents' church. I'm doing youth ministry. That worship leader dies. End up getting into a freak thing. He was 44, had a heart attack. I'm now doing all this extended stuff, and I move to start a band, and I end up moving to Arizona. And while I'm in Arizona, the senior pastor ended up having came out that he had 8 affairs, and I got laid off. And so I'm like back in this place of like, what am I doing with my life? Where do I even believe this anymore? Do I believe in like the church thing? Do I believe in the like the system that I'm in like essentially a big business system for church. And I just felt despondent and felt tired. And luckily, a pastor in Houston, a guy named Chris C, reached out and said, man, just why don't you come down here and just we'll help you just have a place to just be for a while. And we didn't end up moving there. We ended up moving back to Tulsa and just kind of were with family for a bit, but I would go down there. I'm forever grateful to Chris. He's a dear friend. Because he kind of gave me work in a time of like being like, do I really want to work in a church? And we ended up finding our way in New York with the person that I work with now. But the one thing from the very beginning was I was totally always honest about where I was at with Michael. He's the other pastor that I work with in Tribeca. And I feel complete trust with him. Complete trust. And I can be really vulnerable with Michael, I feel like, which was really important for me. But the people that I feel like I can be vulnerable with, it's a small list. Very small list. Like,
right.
That I can actually be honest with, I feel like. And so part of that has been dealing with those own, you know, I say that long story of like, why did you tell the story of the 8 people having the affair and the story of your dad and the story of, I feel like those things shaped me to be like, who can you trust? Who are your friends? I have been, my friends are people that usually, once you're my friend, you're a friend for a long time, but I don't have a ton of friends. I'm friendly with a ton of people and I have a lot of casual friends, but people who are my friends are like my family. They're like my closest confidants. Right. And so once you're in, you know, Ian, you're in. You're one of my godfathers. You know, it's like that's a certain level of trust that I have. But I feel like, and I have to wrestle with this of how do I guard my answer of vulnerability because I have only the people that I can trust? But how do I also be super vulnerable with the people that actually know me? Because I still put up those walls, I feel like. And that's the practice that I'm in of trying to do that and trying to recognize where my ego gets in the way or my pain gets in the way.
Thank you for your very vulnerable and considered answer. I think that's really helpful for people who are trying to, you know, become healthy 8s or love someone who is an 8.
Be sure and join us next week on part 2 with David Gunger. And now we're going to feature a song that Ian wrote with David and David's partner John Arndt. John and David make up the band called The Brilliants, and this song is the title track of the same name, Oh Brother. Enjoy, and we'll see you next week.
When I look into the face of my enemy, I see my brother. I see my brother. When I look into the face of my enemy, I see my brother. I see my brother. Thank you. The garment of our courage, the power to make the peace we long to know. Open up our eyes to see the wounds that bind all of humankind. May our shine. See my brother, I see my